My name is Katie Spester, and our guest today is Richard Lord Morgan, the English bass opera singer turned C of E vicar. Richard, who was born in Nigeria, has performed as a concert artist in many countries. He made his European debut in Berlin in 1987 in Igor Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress, and has sung for several major European houses. In the UK, he sung at Glyndebourne, Opera North, Scottish Opera, and the Royal Opera House. In 1998, he changed direction and was ordained, and later appointed chaplain of King's College, Cambridge, in September 2003, where he also continued to sing. And he has recently retired. So welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you.
So this is the most obvious question to ask, Richard, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask it of you. How did you make this extraordinary transition from being an opera singer, professional opera singer, to being a professional vicar?
I'm going to spool back a wee bit.
Okay, please do.
Only from the point of view of complete accuracy. Otherwise, you'll get letters. I'm a baritone, not a bass.
I beg your pardon. I took this off the internet.
Couldn't matter.
I'm passing the buck here to Dr. Google.
Pass the buck. That's absolutely fine. No, it's only that if somebody said, "Do you want to sing a bass role?" I would be completely stuck. Mm-hmm. So I'm a baritone. I worked at Glyndebourne. But I didn't actually sing in the opera house there. I sang in the Glyndebourne touring opera chorus.
Richard. Come on,
People who work at Glyndebourne might not think so. They're quite sort of sharp about these things. And the only other thing is that one of my grandfathers was English. My other grandfather was Welsh. One of my grandmothers was partly English, and she had a bit of Irish in her. And my other grandmother was completely French, so
you're a mongrel.
I'm a complete mongrel. I wouldn't get into crafts at all. I'm a mongrel. But actually, I quite like that, because it means that it's complicated when you start watching things like rugby matches, and you don't quite know whether to support the Welsh or the French. But apart from that. Crack on. That's great. Yeah.
Well, we got these important things straight.
So, turning from opera to the church, it was really a journey that was fueled by one major event in my life, which I'll come to in a sec, but initially it was really a journey of I was going to say complacency and arrogance mixed.
I'm sorry, just so I'm clear, you're saying you were coming from a place of complacency and arrogance, or your exploration was, shall
a
we say,
a journey fueled by complacency and arrogance.
Fueled, really.
Because I really had no idea what I was doing. In 1992, my partner, who had cancer, died very suddenly. And as a result of that, this was somebody who we'd not been together very long, but he had opened my eyes to an extraordinary wealth of vision, of understanding what it was to have a close companion, another half, and to the whole world of natural history and conservation with which he was involved. So that was. That
so he was a zoologist,
he
was, wasn't he?
He was a wildlife vet. He was a veterinarian.
Ah, yes.
Working. He was from California, from Berkeley. He studied in Berkeley. He was from Santa Barbara, in California, but worked in Rwanda, where he worked with the mountain gorillas, and in the Caribbean, where he worked with, I was going to say orca. It wasn't orca. I think it was dolphins.
Oh, he sounds like a very interesting man.
He was a remarkable man, absolutely remarkable man. And he also played the harpsichord. So, you know, a sort of good example of Renaissance man. And I loved him very much indeed.
What an enormous loss, Richard.
Yeah, it was pretty bloody. And then after he died, we'd both been members of the church here in Clapham. And
that's St. Paul's Church in Clapham Old Town.
Yep. St. Paul's in Old Town. And where we were both very warmly, you know, much warmly welcomed, actually, as a couple.
And this was before the church had accepted homosexual rights in marriage and...
Well, it rather depends who you ask. In some places, the church still hasn't accepted homosexual rights and marriage. But it was certainly well past the sort of the legal change. That was, what was it, 1967? And
I thought the church came much later.
The church did come much later, yes, and I can't remember when civil partnerships were allowed. But you can still get into awful trouble with trying to get married or be blessed in a church. Still, so anyway, that to one side.
Yes, we're going off track. I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's all right.
I'm just very pleased. I'm very pleased. I'm very proud to be part of a community that was at the forefront of taking this as bog standard normal.
Do you know, it wasn't an issue.
Exactly. which is exactly what we want.
How it should be.
Exactly.
And we weren't the only one. I mean, we weren't sort of trailblazers by any means. We were, I think, out of a congregation of, on a Sunday by Sunday, might be 50 people, mm-hmm. roughly, 60 people, sometimes rather fewer. There were six gay and lesbian couples who were welcome there and made to feel perfectly welcome because, as I say, it wasn't an issue. We were just people who were members of the church who contributed to the church community in various ways. And we were just sort of ordinary, really.
Yes.
It wasn't, you know, we didn't feel we were being... You know, having good done unto us. Yeah. Nobody was being
Nobody was being generous and kind. Yeah.
They were just ordinary.
Yeah, wonderful.
So that was great. The only time it wasn't really ordinary is when the vicar, who was a wonderfully wise woman called Helen, invited Barclay and me to bring an orphan wallaby that we were hand raising from London Zoo. Because it was a very small thing and it was only just daring to leave its pouch. Uh-huh. Can't remember the details, but this has got nothing to do with opera, by the way, but never mind, it's much more interesting. we had it in a sort of duffel bag.
I'm sorry, you mean to say in your house you had a wallaby?
Yeah, it was only a small one. I mean, okay. It was a little one, about a sort of, I don't know, just over a foot long, 16 inches or something. And it needed bottle feeding, mm-hmm. however many times a day it was. I'm glad to say it slept through the night, but it needed bottle feeding, and it lived in a duffel bag. And as one does, it was lined with cashmere, because Barclay said, "I'm not having any wallaby orphaned that I'm looking after sleeping on acrylics." So we had it in cashmere.
A man with standards.
I know exactly, and Helen, Mother Helen, said, "Bring the wallaby to church on Mothering Sunday." And we will talk about the art, the skill of mothering, looking after, cherishing.
Nurturing and cherishing
and all that. So we did. And it was all going terribly well until, what was the name of the animal? It was called Woody. Stuck his head out of his duffel bag, woke up and stuck his head out of the duffel bag when we were sitting in the church in the pew. And Sister Alice and Mary, who was one of the community of nuns who lived nearby, thought it was a rat, and rather lost the plot. But anyway, Woody eventually went back to Whipsnade, where I hope he lived a happy life, sort of hopping around the grounds, hopping around the zoo. Anyway, Bark died, and after that, there was a huge sort of you're not prepared for this. I mean, I knew he had cancer, but I wasn't prepared for him to die quite so suddenly. And I remember thinking, well, is that it? Is that it? You know, in terms of what God's plan is, because it's difficult to know what you do with that. You know, where you take it, where you take this sort of weight of emotion and anger and distress and confusion, really.
Indeed.
It's like being sort of hit by a wave, yeah. a sort of tsunami, and you're tumbled upside down. You don't know which way's up and which way's down, and you can't breathe. And it is confusing. And
you
and
also
very,
said
very
in something. Mm. In some, you also said in something that I read. That's something that you wrote. You wrote about how utterly physically exhausting this is, isn't it? A physically exhausting process. This whole confusion and grief just wears you out to the point that you don't even have the energy to kind of grapple with this.
I think it is exhausting. I'm not alone in saying that, because you know your sleeping pattern is completely thrown to the winds, and you are. You're just hurting. You're hurting and trying to, and confused and all that. So I remember thinking, well, where do I go with this? Where do I take this? And in and I'd started seeing a bereavement counsellor who actually, she was a very kind and generous and compassionate woman, but we weren't getting anywhere at all. And little by little by little, over months. This little sort of, it was like having a little imp of mischief, you know, sitting on your shoulder, whispering into your ear. And this word, ordination, kept coming up. And I don't know, it wasn't my idea, I'm quite sure.
It was the imp's.
It was the imp's idea.
Now, there's an example of passing the buck.
It was the imp's idea. And the imp was sort of saying, what about ordination? And then, you react and you say, oh, God, no, not absolutely, you know, never. And the imp then comes back and says, so why not? And that the answer to that is easy. And the answer to that is simply, well, I'm not the type. And the imp then goes away and then comes back after a little while and says, so who's the type?
Who's the type?
And that was the turning point. And because I realized that all the men and women of God who I'd known in my life, who had been influential and memorable, were men and women who had not been the obvious type, in inverted commas. They had been troublesome, confused in some cases, difficult, confrontational, maverick, thorns in the side of the church establishment, infinitely compassionate, sometimes funny, sometimes not.
Sounds like Christ you're describing.
Well, yes, in some cases I think there were very close comparisons with Christ. And I thought, right. Then this needs serious, serious consideration. And eventually I came to see this vicar, our vicar, Helen. And said, and I knew that the moment I mentioned the word ordination, that it would be like the releasing the genie out of the bottle, and sort of no amount of stuffing it would get it back into the bottle. Yeah. It would be out there. So I said to her, I need to come and talk to you about something. And I remember we were in the vestry, and I said, I have just been thinking about this whole issue of ordination. And she didn't say a word, she just grinned from ear to ear. As if she was saying, well, well done, dear. It's, you know, it's taken you a while, but you've finally caught up at last. So instead of sort of hooting with laughter and saying, well, what an interesting idea, see you in church on Sunday.
Yeah.
She said, we need to talk.
Yes, absolutely.
So we talked, and I said, well, what do I do now? And she said, you come and talk to me for quite a long time, and we discuss things. So we did.
But Richard, you must have, and maybe this is just my understanding both of the role of being a vicar and a spiritual life that you lead now. You know, you went from being a very successful opera singer with, you know, an international reputation, who traveled globally around the world singing these extraordinary roles. This is a creative life. It's an artistic life. It's a life of high art. And then you become a spiritual man. Didn't Did you miss the artistic life?
Yes, very much, and I still do. But I don't miss the uncertainty of it.
Oh yes,
The unpredictability. I mean, I was never going to be the great white hope of British baritones. I mean, there were plenty of them around, still are, possibly more now than there were then, who are, you know, have voices given them by the gods. And I was a perfectly competent jobbing baritone who got work that I enjoyed doing. But I wasn't sort of lined up to sing at the Met, or I did sing at La Scala, but it wasn't in opera, it was in a concert. And it was only once. Quite nice, good thing to do. And there were occasionally opera, you know, performances and productions that I was involved in, which were terrifically exciting. And I loved the creative... God, it sounds so pretentious. I loved the creative process where you work on a piece of music. And if you were working at Covent Garden, for example, you really, really worked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a wonderful collection of vocal coaches. And you take the music to the vocal coach more or less as often as you like. And you make sure that you know it absolutely inside out, back mm-hmm. to front and upside down, so that when you do go to rehearsal, you know your stuff.
Sure.
And that is an enormous privilege. Because, okay, there's an enormous amount of work to do at home, especially if you're working on a modern score. It's very difficult to memorize. And the last thing I did... is that right? Yes, the last thing I think I sang in public was an opera in Amsterdam with the Nederlandse opera. And I thought it was going to be my glittering entree into the Dutch sort of operatic scene in the opera house. Not at all. We did it in an old disused gasometer down by the railway.
I do have to say, Richard, that does sound typically Dutch.
In the Westerhuisfabriek.
Yeah,
And it was, I mean, I've talked to people about it now. They say, oh, that's the most wonderful, wonderful. It was a fantastic place. But the opera was written by a French Canadian
mm-hmm.
who was a gay man who was murdered by, I think, somebody he picked up rather rashly and killed by him. And this opera. It is in no known language. There are seven people in the cast, none of whom has a name, and there is no obvious storyline. Well, I mean, you start learning that score for starters.
Wow.
And it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating because you can't, well, you know, there's no thread to follow. However, we had this wonderful, crazy director in Amsterdam.
You'd need to have a crazy director.
Yeah, he was known for being a sort of slightly crazy director who just took us on this extraordinary journey, and the costumes were mad, and they were half our face was covered in latex with sort of protrusions and fake ears and noses, and costumes which were impossible to wear that didn't resemble anything that you or I would recognize as a garment. On a huge broad wasn't a stage, it was just an acting area that was covered in white, very, very fine white sand.
Ooh.
with large cardboard wooden boxes. And we had all the members of the orchestra, there were 9 or 12 of them, discovered, they learnt to their horror, they were going to have to learn their music by heart as well, because they were walking around this acting area with us. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, it was either going to be a resounding flop or else something quite exciting. And in fact, it became a sort of cult.
But can you just please tell me who this French Canadian is?
Yes, he's called Claude Vivier.
Claude Vivier.
Monsieur Vivier. And he was...
And this opera is...
the opera is called Copernicus.
Okay.
Copernicus with a K. And it was astonishing. It was the most extraordinary piece. And actually, by the end, excuse me, we got so familiar with it that it became a wonderful piece. a wonderful piece and very exciting to do.
Everything written needs an editor. As Stephen King once said, to write is human, to edit is divine. It could be a memoir you wrote about growing up, or a copy for business statements, or a racing page turner that you want to present to agents. For highly experienced and professional editing at a reasonable price, contact Clapham Publishing, www.claphampublishing.com, for all your writing needs.
Welcome back to Clareton Conversation. Our guest today is the baritone singer turned vicar, Richard Lloyd Morgan. So, Richard, you were talking about this transition you made from being in the creative industry with all its uncertainty to being a vicar. Is there any possibility that you could have taken with you any skills that the creative industry might have, this artistic life that you had led? Could you have imported them somehow into your work as a vicar? Or they're just too markedly different,
No, no, they're not. They are rather frighteningly similar. I mean, they're obviously, you know, different. You can't replace, as it were, the template of working in an opera company with the template of working in a church. But there are definitely similarities. And one of the similarities I noticed was that, although it hadn't occurred to me when I started thinking about the journey of ordination, was that I found I was sort of exchanging one community of divas for another community of divas. You have to be slightly careful who you say that to if you're talking to members of the church, but some recognize it too. And it's all to do with communication. It's all to do with communication. If you feel that you are, you know, if you're given a piece of, well, not necessarily opera, but let's say if you're doing a song recital, one of the big Schubert song cycles, like Schöne Müllerin or Winterreise, you're standing up there. It's just you and a pianist, and you are communicating a journey for the best part of an hour mm-hmm. 10 or something like that. Okay, you're doing it in a foreign language, and you've got the net of music to communicate with in. So it's not just you talking.
Mm-hmm.
Schubert's done it for you.
Well, that's Müller surely the whole point of music. It's not just talking; you're communicating through music.
So it's exactly, and part of the skill with that is, as it were, getting out of the way. So that it's your voice which is doing the communication. But if you get that wrong, if you somehow get in the way of that, then you're doing your audience a disservice. And I believe that if, as a priest, you get in the way of what God is telling you or using you to communicate to somebody or somebodies in a church or somebody, if you're just doing a one-to-one conversation, then you're not doing that person or that congregation any services.
Don't you find that a little bit controversial, what you just said? It almost suggests that you're somehow a mouthpiece for God or a chant.
I think really? You are.
I hadn't quite expected you to say that.
If you are, if your personality, if you like, gets in the way of your singing an operatic role, I mean, there were some, I'm sure there still are, some absolutely glorious voices on the international circuit. I mean, really, really staggeringly wonderful singers who are very difficult to watch because of their own personal mannerisms. I mean, I can think of one who was a fantastic tenor, who simply said to some directors, "I don't do that."
Mm. So you mean Placido Domingo is always Placido Domingo, no matter what role he's playing?
Well, actually, I wasn't thinking of him, but there are others for a whole variety of reasons. You know, maybe they're not comfortable doing it, or maybe they feel they've been cast in the wrong role, but it's a wonderful, well, because, you know, they're playing a young lover or something, and they're well into their 50s or something.
Yeah.
And vocally they can do it, but on stage it looks ludicrous.
Indeed.
And I believe that the same is true in the church. If you are the person who is actually getting in the way of, okay, there's, it's good, I think, to offer your slant on a particular theological issue. But it's not so good, I think, if you then start banging the your drum, or you know, thumping the tub, or whatever the expression is.
So you have to give up of the ego to create.
I think you have to get out of the way.
I think simply. That's interesting for both creativity and indeed for the church.
You have to get out of the way. That's not to say that you don't employ your really most cherished. That's the wrong word. Your most finely tuned and studied technique, if you like, or thought process, to present the best that you can. But you have to be honest. And if you are not honest, A, an audience will sort of see past you, and B, a congregation will certainly see past you. And you're not doing anybody any favors. You're not doing a congregation any favors, and you're certainly not doing God any favors, I don't think.
And you're also not being a creative artist.
You're not being a creative artist. This idea of creativity in the church, I think, is an important. I do think it's an important one. I mean, I don't really go. My church personship is not really for the theatrical. I feel I've had enough costume changes.
You've done that enough in
my
life.
I've worn enough sort of, you know, heavy gold threaded costumes in my life to not to have to wear them anymore. That's not to say that I would, you know, ban all high church stuff with bells and smells and candles and glittery costumes and all that. Although I think they can get in the way. I think they can get in the way. Other people find them incredibly helpful. And will nourish their sense of the divine.
But how do you say it's like a mechanism by which we access the divine? It's a tool to
correct to
connect at some level that is non-physical, not in the material world.
Yeah. I worked my the only job I've actually been paid for in the church was when I worked in Cambridge at King's College. As the chaplain at King's College in Cambridge for 12 years. And King's has this astonishing choir, chapel choir, which, and you can argue it till the cows come home, but as chapel choirs go, it is considered to be one of the best in the world.
Weren't you a member of it when you were a child?
No, Maya.
You see, this is how, you know, Mr. Google keeps misleading me, because it pretty much assured me you had been.
I was a treble in, before my voice broke, I was a treble in my local village choir.
Okay,
in a small village.
Not quite
in,
Cambridge.
Small village in Gloucestershire. not Cambridge at all. And that was because a woman who we knew with my family had come over from Germany, and she'd brought with her as a Christmas present for us one of those little 45 RPM
yes.
records
indeed.
Of the Vienna Boys Choir singing.
Well, I had one of those as a child
growing
up.
Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. Christmas carols. Yeah.
It might have been the same one. I mean, looking back on it, it was pure syrup. I mean, it was just so saccharine.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't true. But I thought I had died and gone to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one record that we had, which I listened to again and again and again, and just loved the sound.
And is this what inspired you to go into singing as a choir?
So I joined the local church choir as a treble. I mean, aged, 11, something like that. I thought it was just glorious, just utterly, utterly beautiful.
I have to say, it made a very big impression on me too as a youngster. Yes. You know, among all my parents' records.
Yep.
When Christmas would come along and my parents would put on the Vienna Boys Choir, I have a very clear memory of it.
Yeah.
And although it was, you're absolutely correct, pure syrup, but there was nonetheless something transcendent voices.
My word, they can sing. And I mean, irony of ironies, decades later, in fact, it must be about 10 years ago, I went to Vienna and spent a morning in the Vienna Boys Choir school listening to a rehearsal that they were doing with these kids. and then went to church in the Hofkapelle, I think it's called, where the Vienna boys, where the choristers were singing. And my goodness, they worked. As do the choristers at King's. It's a different sound, but my goodness, it's such a gift to worship. There are those who would rather dismiss. I mean, I know members of my family who said, "Oh, it's all this singing in the chapel. It's all to the greater glory of King's, rather than the greater glory of God." And I would actually argue now that that is not so, but I can see where that comes from.
Well, it's become a bit of a brand, Richard.
It has become a brand. And when you get on a Saturday, let's say in the summer, 600 people coming to Evensong, 90% of them are there to hear the choir. More than that, probably 98% of them are here there to hear the choir, and they don't, you know, they don't look up towards the altar. Their concentration and their focus, and in some cases their mobile phones, although we try to stop that, are focused on the choir, mm-hmm. the sound. These little, you know, these kids and the choral scholars.
I have no doubt. But, you know, my church in Canada that we belonged to before we moved to England started up a choir where there was no barrier to entry. You just had to devote yourself to it, if you wish. You know, just enormous amounts of hard work and time. And and we had a choir leader, professional, who played the org. She's an organist, and she's also a superb choir leader. And it was a fantastic church. It was a Dutch Reformed, very strict Protestantism, the kind that makes all the CFE look very Roman in comparison.
Yeah.
But the music was second to none.
Was it?
And in fact, in the little CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, competition of church choirs, everybody was a rank amateur. We came second nationally after a Roman Catholic. And I thought, well, yes, of course, the Catholics.
After Roman Catholic.
Yeah, the Catholics would have a better church choir. You know, that struck me as very reasonable. There weren't that many strict Presbyterian Dutch Calvinists in downtown Toronto. But there were enough who loved music that they came to this Calvin church.
Yes.
And just sang their guts out.
There's no doubt it can be an extraordinarily, I was taken when I was 15 by a friend of my family to King's when I was a schoolboy to the Advent Carol service. And this was, this was before the ceiling, the vault was cleaned. So the place was dark and smoky, and I and this family friend were way, way, way in the darkness somewhere. And out of this darkness came this extraordinary sound. And I can remember the hairs on the back of my neck standing up and thinking, this is otherworldly. And there are times when I know that other people have been affected in the same way. And if one can do that, it's nothing to do. It's not exclusively to do with church music. I mean, there are bits of all sorts of music, not just the voice, where you are so moved by what you're hearing that you almost forget to breathe.
Yes.
And I don't know anybody, actually it's an interesting one, I've never had a conversation with anybody who says, well, that's never happened to me. There are always bits of music of all genres of music which really, you know, they go to the heart, and very often it's very, very difficult to say why. And I think that's the same with art, the piece of painting that you see on the wall, or a bit of sculpture, or a bit of poetry, or a novel, or a landscape, something that goes right to your heart, or a piece of the Bible, even, that goes right to your heart, and you are unable to say why. I don't know what it is. It's sort of, I don't know whether there's a science to it, or whether it, it sort of coincides with your biorhythms or your DNA.
It just accesses a different part of you.
Yes. And, you know, you're moved to tears by something that you cannot explain.
Yes.
And There was a case in point. I mean, there's a bit in Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, quite near the beginning of the book, when a character dies, a girl dies of tuberculosis. And when I read it and the description of her grave, when I read it the first time, I just howled and howled because I found it so incredibly moving. And I was in my teens, I guess. And then years and years and years later, I thought, I wonder if that was just because I was at that age and it came to me as such a surprise, Helen's death. And I thought, I'm going to read it again. And I just took the book off the shelf, read that chapter only, and I howled all over again.
How wonderful.
It was very strange. Yeah. And it was the description of Helen's grave, which has one word on it, and the one word is resurgam, I shall rise again. And that's all it said. And funnily enough, I wanted to put that on Barclay's gravestone in Santa Barbara, where he's buried. But his family his family got there first and put some other things. Does it matter? Not in the least. But it would have been an interesting sort of link, an interesting hookup to the past. But it is. I mean, there are bits of music that now I hear again and again and again, usually involving the human voice, which absolutely blow me away. And I, you know, music for which I am incredibly grateful.
Indeed.
Because it connects me with something other.
Well, I think that's the whole thing about art, is that it enlarges us.
Yeah. Yes.
And also, I think, acts as a bridge to other people who are like us. So our enlarged being connects with other people's. And this is why, you know, you can have people sitting around talking about novels or going to concerts together or going to book readings or making music together. It acts as a glue as well as an enlargement.
And how lucky are we that we can access it?
Indeed.
I mean, we have opportunities to go to art galleries or go to cinema or go to concerts or whatever, and hear and see and read stuff which enlarge the soul.
Absolutely.
And I think it's an obvious link to religion, in my case Christianity, is that it enlarges the soul. And I don't have the answers. I mean, if somebody says, sort of prove God to me, I'll turn around and walk away. How can you prove the infinite?
Yeah.
How can you prove? It's like saying, just explain to me what happens when the cosmos ends. You know, what happens when you take another step? Where are you? Well, the cosmos doesn't end. I mean, God doesn't end. How can you explain the inexplicable, the infinite? Maybe Professor Brian Cox can. I'm nowhere near there. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you know, you get that bit, that wonderful bit in Isaiah when God says, "I have called you by name." God saying, I mean, not sort of your school teacher or your parent or a policeman saying, God saying, "I have called you by name and kept you. I have taken you by the hand. I have chosen you. You are my chosen one, and I love you for who you are." Not for some sort of impossible model of excellence and wonder and goodness that you could never be because you're human. I've created you as you are, and I love you as you are, and I want you, which is why eventually I came to this, to the church business, to this idea of ordination.
So, Richard, what would you say? You know, if you can say, and you may not be able to, what do you think has been what you have given back? What have you given back to the creative world? Has it been maybe music and church, or has it just been your church service? Your service to understanding, maybe just your internal journey. Maybe that in and of itself is a gift.
It's kind of three-dimensional. I mean, okay. not yesterday, but the Sunday before, I was I was two paragraphs into a sermon where I was invited to preach at a church in Chelsea, and I was just warming to my theme, and somebody got up and walked out rather ostentatiously, and I thought, oh right. Actually, if you'd waited until I was on to the next paragraph, you'd have really walked out. So I'm really sorry. I'm very sorry that you. But you know, we haven't had the opportunity to talk through why I've said what I said, and I'm sorry if you're offended. But I will stick to it. Similarly, before I started this life of singing, I played a viola at school, and my last public performance as a viola player was to give my rather individual interpretation of Telemann's Viola Concerto, which, it has to be said, is not a difficult piece, but I hadn't worked at it, hadn't practiced hard enough. And it was in public. It shouldn't have been, but it was in public. And somebody came up afterwards with a rather puzzled expression and said, "What a very interesting interpretation." I had absolutely no idea a viola could make a noise like that. And I thought, oh, how very kind. And then I thought, actually, no, not so. So the viola, I've never taken, it's been back in its box ever since. But conversely, I sang at a festival in Cornwall, the St. Endelian Festival, which is a wonderful place. And I sang a Schubert cycle late one night by candlelight and with a wonderful pianist. And we did it all from memory, at least I did, all from memory without a break. And it was one of those evenings where I went into a completely different place on this journey, this sort of vocal journey. And it is a journey, that song cycle. And when you start it, you think, I have no idea whether I'm going to get to the end of this, you know, without forgetting the words or forgetting the music or losing my voice or having to go and have a drink of water, whatever. Anyway, you just start. It's like the beginning of any journey. You take one step. And after about the first 10, 12 songs, you sort of, in your mind, look over your shoulder and you think, gosh, I've come a long way and it's been unexpected. And so you then go on with the journey. And then a year later, I was back at the same festival and I was sitting in the pew in the church and a man at another concert looked over his shoulder and he said, "Did you sing that Schubert recital here last year?" I said, yes, I did. And he said, I've been feeding on that all year."
Wow, what and a compliment.
I nearly burst into tears.
Yes, of course.
Because I was kind of expecting him after the viola debacle to say, "Oh, that was a load of rubbish, wasn't it?" But he didn't. He said, "I've been nourished. I've been feeding off that for a year." And that's all you can do. I mean, that's all you can do. When you preach a sermon, you have no idea. When you sing an opera, when you sing a recital, when you do a concert, you have no idea where it's going to go, who is going to be listening, what the needs of individuals in your congregation or your audience are going to be, and you offer it in the best possible faith, and you try and speak truth to, or sing truth to you, to yourself. And curiously enough, often the best thing is to not say, "I've learned to not say anything at all," so that if somebody comes and asks you, as somebody once did, some very serious, troubling, well, questions about very things that were really serious and troubling for them, and they talked and talked and talked and talked, and all I did, literally all I did, was to say, "Gosh, yes, yes, really, yes, and yes." And at the end, he sort of wound this conversation, drew the conversation to a close by saying, "Well, thank you. You've given me some really good advice." And I hadn't said a word. I mean, I really hadn't said a word. And I remember thinking, I think that's God.
Yeah.
I think that's God. In other words, Richard, just get out of the way. And if you're singing Schubert, get out of the way. Schubert's done it. All you've got to do is be that conduit. Actually, I'm not the only singer to say that. I think Janet Baker, you know, the great, great, great singer, said that I am a conduit for what other people have written. And when you watch her, and one of the pieces that I go back to on YouTube is her singing the that sort of poem in the Mahler Second Symphony. The poem's called Urlicht. And she stands, it's Leni Bernstein conducting, and I think they're filming in Ely Cathedral. And she stands there and she barely moves a muscle. And she just sings.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch that and I think, that's all you've got to do. Okay, if you're doing opera.
Yeah. That's all. I mean, but...
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
do you know
what
I mean? Mahler's done it. Get out of the way. God's done it. Get out of the way.
On that note, I'd like to thank this very humble, very thoughtful man for his contribution to our community and to our artistic world. Thank you very much for joining us, Richard Lloyd Morgan.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Claret in Conversation was brought to you by our sponsor, Clapham Publishing Services. It was executive produced, sound recorded, and edited by Teddy Ethoft. If you liked Claret in Conversation, please subscribe, share, and comment.